Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Jack Cordes, member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors, Northern California Regional Chair of BNY Mellon Wealth Management, and your chair for tonight's program. Tonight's program is about planned giving, also known as charitable gift planning, and how individuals can use charitable gifts to solve family and financial problems and ultimately protect your family's future. It is my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished speaker, Eric Dryberg, estate planning expert, principal in the law firm of Adler and Colvin, and board member of the Partnership for Philanthropic Planning. Eric's areas of expertise include charitable gift planning, charitable estate planning, and not-for-profit organizations. He has authored the chapter Charitable Remainder Trust in California Estate Planning, a leading estate planning publication, and numerous other articles on charitable gift planning. He is a co-editor of the Charitable Gift Planning News. His memberships include the Board of Directors of the Partnership for Philanthropic Planning, past board member of the San Francisco Estate Planning Council and the Northern California Plan Giving Council, and co-chair of the Charitable Planning Committee of the American Bar Association's Real Property, Trust, and Estate Section. Eric received the 2005 Phil Hoffmeyer Service Award from the Northern California Plan Giving Council and is a fellow of the highly prestigious American College of Trust and Estate Council. Eric has an undergraduate business degree from the University of Wisconsin and his JD at the University of California at Berkeley, Bolt Hall. He is also a certified public accountant. Please welcome Eric Dryberg.
Well, I would like to thank Jack for that kind introduction. I do a lot of speaking both here and nationally, and there's always a bit of risk being involved with somebody introducing you who knows you, because they often know you too well. But Jack, true to his profession, was discreet, and I appreciate that. I'd like to chat tonight about charitable gift planning, plan giving as it's often called, and sort of what it can all mean for you. Now, there's always sort of two sides to charitable gift planning. There's the why side and the how side. And the why side includes, of course, giving back to the community, supporting charities that you care about. But it also ties into what is sort of the current trend in estate planning, which is values-based estate planning. And people are starting to realize that it's not just enough when they do their estate planning to say, I want to minimize my taxes to zero and give every dollar I own to my kids. People are starting to say, maybe that's not really that all my estate plan should do is minimize taxes and give every dollar to their children. And they're starting to think about things like, how do I move my legacy and values and traditions on to the next generation? And oftentimes, charitable gift planning starts to become part of that process. There was a wonderful talk here a few years ago, June of 07, actually, by Tom Rogerson, who is actually with BNY Mellon, and you can find it on the internet. And he talks a lot about values-based estate planning and how to involve the children in philanthropy and things like that. I, however, being an attorney, am a bit less on the why side and a bit more on the how side. How do we actually implement charitable giving? Why is it important to people, and what are they accomplishing? And what I've come to learn over the years is that charitable gift planning actually is most attractive and most successful when we're actually helping a donor solve problems. And I've come to believe that charitable gift planning is actually problem solving. And people have a lot of interesting problems. Oftentimes, a charitable gift plan can help. They need more income or a safe, steady, secure source of income, particularly in these times. They may have concerns about supporting dependents after they're gone, be it the unmarried partner, the parent, the spendthrift child. They may even today, surprisingly, have an appreciated asset that they're getting ready to sell and worried about paying the capital gains tax. And for situations like that, a charitable gift can actually help the donor solve their problem, secure a gift to charity, and be part of that values-based estate planning where, frankly, the children are watching mom and dad make a gift to charity. That's the best way to show kids about values and traditions in passing on the legacy of charitable giving is to do it and to do it responsibly. So what I want to do in the time I have is talk about some of the common situations I've seen where a charitable gift plan has really come in to help the donor accomplish their problems. So what's one common problem folks are having these days? I don't have enough income, or the income I have isn't steady, secure, safe. I'm really worried about my future sources of support. Well, you know, the classic individual, the classic person that I want to chat about is, let's say, a 77-year-old single person has, let's say, $50,000 in a money market. They're not getting a lot of interest off of that money market. And if you're talking about somebody who is concerned about getting more income, has an interest in supporting charity, and may even want an income tax deduction, we have a solution for them. And the solution is called a charitable gift annuity. Charitable gift annuity. Now, it's a pretty simple concept, actually. In my example, let's call her Mrs. Smith, the 77-year-old, takes the $50,000 and gives it to charity. And in exchange, the charity promises to pay her an annuity for life. Now, these annuities are age-based, so the older you are, the higher the annuity rate is. And I'll talk about where the rates come in a minute. But for a 77-year-old, the rate is 6.6%. So on $50,000, that's $3,300 a year for her life, backed by the full faith and credit of the charity. On top of that, not only is there a $3,300 return every year, but if she gives cash, about two-thirds of that return is actually going to be tax-free, and only one-third, about $1,100, is going to be taxable as ordinary income. So she's going to get a 1099 every year, like you get from you know, your various stock and bond holdings. But out of the $3,300 Mrs. Smith is going to get, only about $1,100 or $1,200 is going to be taxable, and the balance is going to be tax-free. That's a fairly high after-tax rate of return. She also gets an income tax deduction because she has, in fact, made a gift to charity. She's reserved the income, if you will, off of that asset for her life, but when she passes away, the residuum is going to be in the hands of the charity to do the charity's good work, and she's entitled to an income tax deduction. Now, it's not for the full amount of the $50,000 she gave because, of course, the charity doesn't have that today. They only have the gift in the future, so it's a present value concept where we try to determine in today's dollars what the value of her gift is going to be when she ultimately passes away. Again, the IRS has a actually they have a couple of tables about 6 inches high that one has to use unless you have a computer. And in this situation, 77-year-old woman doing a charitable gift annuity, her income tax deduction is about $23,000, 40 to 50% of the value of what she transferred. So what are the benefits to Mrs. Smith here? Well, number one, fixed payments backed by the full faith and credit of the charity. Again, age-based annuity rates. If, for example, she was aged 83, her rate would be 7.7%. So as you get older, the rate goes up. This is a fairly simple gift to establish. The contract, if you will, with the charity is generally about a page and a page and a half long, so it's fairly simple to understand. And as a result, charities can do these transactions at fairly small dollar amounts. Many charities have a gift minimum for charitable gift annuities on the order of $10,000 or $15,000, so you don't have to have $100,000 to get involved in something like this. And you can get some fairly favorable tax consequences on the payouts. Obviously, a lot of people look at this transaction and go, but I'm a little worried. How do I know that the charity is going to be there to pay my annuity going forward? And we in the state of California are either blessed or cursed, depending upon how you look at it, with the fact that charitable gift annuities issued to California residents are subject to regulation by the California Department of Insurance. And, in fact, there is some law in the California Insurance Code about charities issuing annuities to California residents. To issue an annuity to a California resident, a charity, first of all, has to secure a license from the Department of Insurance. And I can assure you that is a very arduous process, and there's a great deal of review put in by the Department of Insurance to ensure that only financially sound charities are in the business of issuing annuities in the first place. And I believe at last count there were something about 400 charities in the state that were, or 400 charities that were actually entitled and licensed to issue annuities in the state of California. Some of those are California charities. Some of those are large out-of-state charities that have large California constituents. But you have to get a license to issue an annuity. Secondly, under the law, the charity needs to establish a reserve trust, a separate trust, legal trust, into which all of the gifts go and out of which the annuity payments come until Mrs. Smith dies, and then her little sliver of that reserve trust is peeled off, and that's when the charity actually gets to spend the money. So there is the separate reserve trust holding the funds with some fairly conservative investment standards imposed, again, by the California Insurance Code as sort of an additional, if you will, safety net. And finally, the California Department of Insurance gets an annual report every year from the charity on its gift annuity program and on the reserve trust, which, again, they review fairly carefully. So you not only have sort of the financial wherewithal of the charity backing these up, but you have the California Department of Insurance as well. And they are quite fond of telling me, as they have on several occasions, that no charity has ever defaulted on a gift annuity in California. And they take that as a point of pride. So there is, again, I'm not here to guarantee any particular charity's gift annuity program, but they have been pretty secure for a long time. While I tend to talk about these as fairly small in the relative terms gifts, $10,000, $50,000, things like that, I will say I did a talk like this several years ago up in Napa. And afterwards, somebody came up to me afterwards and said, you know, Eric, that example of the 77-year-old was just fine, except I'm not actually 77. I'm only 76. Could you rerun the numbers for me to see what it would look like? And I said, sure, I'd be glad to do that. And I reran the numbers. And as you might guess, they aren't much different, only a year younger. Turns out that later that year, she did a $500,000 charitable gift annuity. And 6 months after that, she did a second one for $500,000. She did $1 million worth of gift annuities with this particular charity. So finally, the charity called her up and said, gee, this is great. Why? And she said, you know, she was fairly well off and had a large investment portfolio. And as would be appropriate for somebody of that age, a fair bit of the investment portfolio was in fixed incomes, you know, bonds, government, corporate bonds, and so on. And then part of it was in stocks. And she said, you know, Eric, this is a great fixed income portion of my portfolio. I've got bonds. Why not do a charitable gift annuity? It's that same bond concept of a steady rate of return every single year. I can't cash it in, of course, and it's going to charity at my death. But if what I'm looking for out of the fixed income side of my portfolio is a steady income stream, this is a pretty good return. So she used it as part of her fixed income side of the portfolio in a much larger way, I think, than most owners do. But the charity was quite pleased that she did. So, if our first situation is the donor who is saying, I need some more income from me now, charitable gift annuity is a possible solution. What other situations do I see come up over and over and over again where, again, a charitable gift can really come in and be a big help? Well, if you talk to anybody who's on the fundraising side of a charity, they will tell you the biggest part of their development plan giving effort are bequests. And that's when people make a gift to charity in their will or revocable living trust. And that's pretty obvious, right? I mean, it's an easy thing to do. You just draft it into your will. It's entirely revocable until the day you die. So if you change your mind on which charity to give it to, you can just redo your will. It actually doesn't cost you anything during your life because you keep all the money. It only happens at death. And for those people who are in the estate tax bracket and looking at the prospects of paying estate tax when they pass away, well, if you give money to charity, of course, it's deductible. So the charity would get 100 cents on the dollar for every dollar you give them, whereas if you leave it to your children and you're in the estate tax situation, you will, of course, lose currently about 45 cents on every dollar to the IRS. Now, as a sidebar, many people realize that our estate tax law is in a great state of flux. If you believe the law as it's currently written, it's supposed to disappear next year. With no estate tax whatsoever, commonly known in my profession as the throw mama from the train year. And then it's all supposed to come back in 2011 under the old rules. None of us really think that's going to happen. And somewhere between now and the end of the year, we have to get an estate tax bill passed. I have no crystal ball. But certainly the forces seem to be gelling around not repeal, but rather perhaps even an estate tax that looks fairly much like it does now with a $3.5 million exemption per person and a tax rate of 45%. There are a number of bills floating around, as you might suspect, but certainly a few of them are focusing in on unified credit amount, a tax-free amount of about $3.5 million with a 45% bracket. And there are some others that would bring that unified credit amount down to $2 million. I, frankly, do not have a crystal ball, but I can guess that somewhere in that general range is what we're going to see at the end of the day. Anyhow, bequests are wonderful. What's the problem? The problem is that people give the wrong asset to charity. They give the wrong asset to charity. And why? Well, think about what your estate plan looks like. If you've got a bequest in it, where is it? It's in your will or living trust. I give my next-door neighbor so much, I give my favorite nephew so much, I give my favorite charity so much, and then the residue of my estate, if I'm the second to die, goes off to the kids. That's great. What's in your will or living trust, of course, governs the disposition of most of your assets. What asset does it not govern the distribution of? Your retirement plan. Your IRA passes by virtue of the beneficiary designation, as do your life insurance policies, by the way. All right. And what's your IRA beneficiary say? Well, for most people, it says, if I'm the first to die, give it to my spouse. If I am the second to die, give it to the kids. And in fact, that's why you've got the charitable gift in the wrong place, because it's in the will or living trust, not in the IRA beneficiary designation. And why is that? Because IRAs, like all of your other assets, will be subject to estate tax if you're over that threshold. IRAs, unlike almost all of your other assets, are also subject to income tax upon receipt by your heirs. Almost every asset that your heirs receive by gift or bequest, they get tax-free. You may have a gift tax, you may have an estate tax to pass it down to them, but they get the asset tax-free. IRAs are not that way. When they get your IRA at your due to your death, they're going to pay income tax on it, just like you would if you took it out during life. IRAs are great retirement plan vehicles. They are lousy wealth distribution vehicles because they can be subject to both estate tax and income tax before they get down into your kids' hands. It's pretty easy with a 45% estate tax rate and the kind of income tax rates we have around here to see a combined marginal tax rate on your IRA if you're leaving it to your children of up to 70%. I heard a lawyer talk about this in much more detail in an estate planning conference. He happened to be from New York. And he said, I can do better than that. Let's assume somebody is a U.S. resident, subject to U.S. tax, a New York State resident, which apparently has an estate tax, a New York City resident, which apparently has a tax as well, and instead of giving it to the kids, they give it to the grandkids, which is even a further tax expenditure. He got to an effective tax rate on an IRA distribution to the grandkids for his New York City resident of 101%. The tax was more than the money they got. And it's true. When they get the money, they'll get a 1099. So that's sort of a problem. A 70% tax rate is seen as a problem. What's the solution? Well, if you're married, the first solution is die first. Because if you leave everything to your spouse, there is no estate tax due to the unlimited marital deduction, and the spouse can roll over the IRA into their IRA and not have to pay that income tax. But if you're not going to die first, your solution is either to do some fairly complicated and expensive planning, and there is, for some people, some planning that can be done to sort of defer the tax. But another great solution is to leave your IRA to charity. Because charities, number one, qualify for the estate tax deduction, so there is no estate tax on the portion of your IRA that you leave to charity, and they're tax exempt. So they get the 1099, but they don't have to pay any income tax. Charities will get 100 cents on the dollar. Whereas your kids, in the worst case, might get 30 cents on the dollar. So that's a pretty attractive solution. Some people I have talked to have said, you know, I'm not really all that philanthropic, but if I'm going to have to pay 70 cents on every dollar of my IRA to Uncle Sam, and my kids only get 30 cents, to heck with that, I'm going to leave it to charity. I have more often, however, seen people who are philanthropic, who have a bequest in their living trust or their will, once they understand this concept, go back and redo their planning. And the will now says everything to the children, and they build the charitable bequest into their IRA beneficiary designation. And it's actually, again, like charitable gift annuities, a fairly simple transaction to do. You get a change of beneficiary form from your IRA custodian, and where it says primary beneficiary, spouse, second beneficiary, right now it says to the kids in equal shares, that's where you can build in some money to charity and some to your children. And there's a variety of ways to do it. You can split it in shares. You can give the charity a fixed amount. There's different ways of doing it, but it is relatively straightforward. So I find that to be really attractive to a lot of people. Once they get their hands around this concept, they're giving their assets to charity out of the IRA, not out of their will. Some people, once they've gotten this concept down, have said, you know, I now really understand the problem of having my IRA, which is it's income to me as I take it out. If I pass away and leave it to my kids, it's going to be income to them. I am philanthropic. I'd like to give it to charity, but I'd like to see something good happen with my money now. Can I give my IRA to charity now and start the good works now? The answer has historically been, well, yes, but it's not very efficient, because historically, when you pulled money out of your IRA, even if you gave it to charity, taking it out of your IRA was going to be income to you, and you would get a 1099. And then when you gave the money to charity, of course, you'd have a charitable contribution deduction, and maybe they washed out and maybe they didn't. But the point that held a lot of people up was, if I take money out of my IRA, I'm going to get a 1099. It's going to be income to me. I don't want to do that. Well, we've had now several years of a wonderful exception to that rule, and currently this exception is closing at the end of 2009. It came into play in 06 and 07. It was extended for 08 and 09. Whether it will be extended again or not, I don't know. But under this window of opportunity, we are able to do what is known as a IRA rollover, and you can roll your IRA or part of your IRA directly to charity. And it is literally a direct distribution from your IRA custodian to the charity. You don't want to run it through your own bank account. You want a direct distribution to the charity out of your IRA. And the consequences of doing that are, A, the charity has your money. Secondly, it counts against your minimum distribution amount, for those of you that are worrying about that. But on the tax side, nothing happens. It is not income to you. It is not a deduction to you. It's a complete wash. And that, of course, makes sense, because you never paid tax on the money that went into your IRA, so you should not be able to give it to charity and take a second deduction. But it avoids having to take it into income by pulling it out and then hoping you get a charitable contribution deduction when you give it to charity. It's a straight pass-through to the charity. Now, we are limited under these rules to a transfer of up to $100,000 a year, and you must be 70 and a half in order to take advantage of it. But apparently a lot of people have found this very attractive. There was some statistics assembled when this law first came into play, which was the last, I think, 4 months of 2006. We had about 4 months. And there was some self-reporting going on, so certainly not all of these got reported, but the statistics indicate that something like $30 million was given to charity in that four-month period through these IRA rollover gifts. And what I found very interesting is they really seemed to fall into two camps. We sort of had a barbell approach. On the one end were a lot of very small gifts. Over half of the gifts were $5,000 or less. They weren't the $100,000 gifts. They were the small ones. And I sat back and I said, why is that? First of all, I think it's just easy to do. You direct your IRA custodian to make the distribution to charity, and it comes out of your IRA account. That's a little easier to handle than writing that check for $5,000 and watching it come out of your checking account, because, of course, your IRA is sort of sitting off there, and you get a little distribution off of it every year, but it's not like you have to go actually raid your checking account to make the gift happen. And there are also a lot of people who, for example, can't itemize their charitable contributions, so that if they did it the other way, they'd have $5,000 of income. When they pulled the money out, they'd make a gift to charity. It wouldn't do them any good because they're not itemizing their deductions. So we saw a lot of very small ones. The other very large group happened to be very large. People were maxing out. They were doing $100,000 in 2006. Often, if it was a married couple, they'd each do $100,000. You turn around in January or February the next year, they did a second $100,000. So they were trying to max out on this opportunity. And I think here you found people who were very philanthropic, had very large IRAs, had really gotten their hands around this being a very expensive asset to leave to the children. They're interested in charity, and here's a great way to start moving that expensive asset out to charity sooner rather than later. Whether this statute will be extended beyond 2009, I have absolutely no idea, but it would be a wonderful thing if it was. So if we've talked about a little bit about securing a source of income, dealing with your problem asset, your IRA, I want to move to a third topic. A lot of charitable giving is also focused on people who have a large tax event in their life, the sale of a highly appreciated asset that's going to trigger a lot of capital gains. That's troublesome to them. Often a charitable gift can come in as a solution. People don't tend to think they have highly appreciated assets these days. But, in fact, a lot of people do. And what is that asset? It's your residence. It's your residence. I'm working with a lot of people who have, purchased a house. They've gone through their life. They've educated their children. They've sent them off to college. They've watched them come back after college, move back in. They've sent them away a second time. Or they're still there, but they've figured out, I got to get rid of the kid somehow, and the only way I'm going to do it is to sell a house. But they're ready to sell the house. And, you know, these people are moving into a smaller home. They are moving into the condo. And, frankly, a lot of them are moving into one of these assisted living facilities, like the San Francisco Towers or the Presbyterian Sequoias. And they're sort of downsizing. And all of a sudden they come to realize, boy, that house I paid $250,000 for back in the 70s is now worth $1.5 million. So what happens when they get ready to sell that house? Well, you have a sales price of $1.5 million. You have a tax basis, which you get to offset against your sales price, of $250,000. And you have an exclusion for the sale of your primary residence. If you're married, it's $500,000. If you're single, it's $250,000. Well, if we have a married couple and have $1.5 million of sales proceeds with a $250,000 basis and a $500,000 exclusion, they have $750,000 of capital gains when they sell that house. That's an expensive transaction. So what can we do for them? Well, we can make use of a charitable gift device known as a charitable remainder trust, a CRT, charitable remainder trust. So what's that? That is the topic of another hour and a half discussion, but said briefly, it's a trust. It's a separate legal entity, 15 pieces of paper if your lawyer is brief, 45 if he likes to go on. And it basically says the donor contributes this asset to the trust, and the trustee is going to manage the asset. The trustee shall typically sell the asset and pay an income stream to the donor for life. And there's plenty of different forms and variations and twists and turns, but this is the typical one. Pay income to them for life. When they pass away, the trust terminates, and whatever is left in the trust goes to charity. Hence, charitable remainder. The charity gets what's left over after the donor has taken their income stream out for life. Why do people do these? Well, number one, when they fund that trust and transfer an asset into it, there is an income tax deduction, a charitable contribution income tax deduction, because they are making a gift to charity. It's irrevocable. Now, it happens to be, again, out in the future, so they don't get a deduction for every dollar they put in. Again, you have this present value concept. If you're 90, your deduction is a fairly high percentage of what you put in because, frankly, your life expectancy isn't that long. If you're 40, that deduction is a fairly small percentage of the assets you put in the trust because the charity is not going to get anything for 50 years. Again, IRS tables will tell us what the number is. But there is an income tax deduction for some portion of the assets that go in the trust. Secondly, the trust is tax exempt. It does not pay tax. So it can sell that highly appreciated asset and not pay the capital gains tax. So you have the full sale proceeds sitting inside the trust from which you are going to earn income instead of the after-tax sales proceeds. So people tend to love these. And again, you can have variations about the form of the payout. Is it a fixed annuity? Is it variable based on the value of the trust? Does it run for life? Does it run for a term of years? Does it run for one person's life or two persons' lives? Nonetheless, the concept makes a lot of sense. And how would we employ it in this situation? The key is it's not an all or nothing transaction. You don't have to put the whole asset into the trust. So let's take, for example, a couple aged 75 have the house I just described worth $1.5 million. If they sell the house themselves, they have $750,000 of capital gain. What might I propose? I might propose that they think about taking a one-third interest in that house and transferring it into the charitable remainder trust. So they own two-thirds in their own name, just as they have, and as, if you will, sort of a co-tenant, this charitable remainder trust now owns one-third, two-thirds, one-third. You do this transaction when you're getting ready to sell. So now they're going to take the house to market. They're going to hire the agent and put the house on the market. What are the consequences of them doing this? Well, number one, when they funded the trust with this $500,000 one-third share of the house, they get an income tax deduction for that future gift to charity. If they're 75 years old and they've selected a 6% payout on this trust, their income tax deduction is about $219,000, roughly 40%. That's one. Two, when the house is sold, the CRT sells its share tax-free. So it sells its one-third $500,000 portion of the house and gets the full $500,000 and doesn't pay capital gains tax on it. What about the two-thirds that my couple is selling personally? Well, they get $1 million of sale proceeds, correct? Two-thirds. Number two, they get to offset some of their tax basis against that sale. Now, they can't offset their full $250,000 of tax basis because they gave a third of the house away, so they only have two-thirds of their basis left. That's $167,000. What about that one-time exclusion on the sale of your principal residence? $500,000? Yes, they get to use the full $500,000 still, even though they put one-third of the house in the trust. So they have that available to offset the gain. And they just got a $219,000 charitable contribution deduction. So they have $1 million of sales proceeds, $167,000 of tax basis as an offset, $500,000 of their exclusion as an offset, and a $219,000 income tax deduction as an offset. Their capital gains on the sale of that house is down to $114,000. So they have a pot of money inside the charitable remainder trust with $500,000, off of which they're getting 6% a year, and their in-hand proceeds are now $1 million minus the tax they have to pay on $114,000. That can be a great answer for somebody that's philanthropically motivated, that sees that gift at their life to charity as a good thing, and it's a great way to save taxes. You, in a sense, have money in your hand, and you've got a steady income-generating source of money off of the charitable remainder trust. Now, before we all launch off and do this, just a couple points of caution. Number one, again, these transactions make the most sense when you're getting ready to sell the house. And, in fact, with a residence, once you put that one-third interest in the trust, you need to move out. You cannot live inside your charitable remainder trust. So, again, it's a good transaction for somebody that's getting ready to move. Secondly, debt. If your house is encumbered, you have a transaction that is somewhere between difficult and fatal. Debt is somewhere between difficult and fatal. It can be worked with in some cases, but definitely it takes a little bit of extra work. And finally, while you want to do this when you're ready to sell the asset, you cannot wait until you already have sold the asset. You need to put the house into the charitable remainder trust before you have a binding obligation to sell. If you're in escrow, it's too late. So I generally work with people to get the house ready to sell. We put it in the charitable remainder trust. We list the house the following day. You don't want to be waiting until your house is out there on the market and you're getting offers and it starts to look like you have a deal, or it may be viewed by the IRS as if you sold the house, you owe all the tax, and then you put cash in afterwards. So please don't wait too long. Now, charitable remainder trusts are wonderful vehicles for people, again, sort of liquidating a highly appreciated asset in avoiding some capital gains tax. They also have an entirely different use that I see quite often as well. And it starts to come out of people who are worried about the fact that they have dependents that they are taking care of during their life, and they're worried about who's going to take care of these folks financially after they're gone. And sometimes we're talking about the spendthrift child, where mom and dad are basically supporting them, and when they pass away, the one thing they know they can't do is leave him $1 million or $2 million because he's a spendthrift and he's going to blow it. So how do we solve that problem? And, of course, a trust can come into play where you put the money in trust and he only gets the income. But that's just the start of it. Frankly, I see a lot of this concern with unmarried couples, because if you're a married couple in the eyes of the federal tax law, which unfortunately means truly married, you can pass assets to your spouse without incurring any estate tax due to the estate tax marital deduction. That is not true if you're an unmarried couple, and that is whether you're a same-sex couple, a heterosexual couple that just happens to be unmarried. I frankly gave this talk in my home state of Wisconsin in Milwaukee at one point, and there I thought this would play a little better if I talked about the two elderly spinsters who lived out on the farm who have exactly the same problem as many people here do, which is they aren't married. Their plan is to leave everything to the other, but because they are not married in the eyes of the federal tax law, that's all going to be subject to estate tax. We also see it where folks are, the highly successful person is supporting their parents, and they're worried about who's going to support my parents once I'm gone. What kind of problems do these folks have? Well, they've got somebody that they need to provide a source of income for once they're gone. Perhaps they want professional investment advice regarding that money as well, some professional administration and investment advice wrapped around that money. Often there's a need to prevent that person from accessing the principal. That's the spendthrift child. Or in many cases, it doesn't matter whether they have access to the principal or not. All they really need is the income stream. The parent needs the income stream. The partner needs an income stream, but doesn't really need to access the money, so we can tie up the access to the money. And the big problem is we often have an estate tax issue here, because in the situations I just described, when the party dies and leaves money to the spendthrift child, the parent, the unmarried partner, that's all going to be subject to estate tax because we don't have a marital deduction to work with here. So what's our solution? Well, one solution that often comes into play is doing a charitable remainder trust for this person at death. You don't create it during life. You do it as part of your estate plan, and it's literally in your will or trust. And it says, when I pass away, take $1 million, put it into a charitable remainder trust. I name so-and-so or such-and-such bank as trustee, and pay income for life to my spendthrift child, my partner, my parent. How does that work? Well, haven't we accomplished a lot of what we're trying to do? We're going to provide an income stream for that person for life, and it can be 5% of the fair market value of the assets. It can be 7% of the fair market value of the assets, however we define it. You've provided management over those assets in the form of a professional investment advisor, bank trustee. You have precluded access to principal, which may be a good thing or may just flat out not be a problem, but you have provided for a stream of income, and because there is the charitable remainder element of this charitable remainder trust, there will be an estate tax deduction available. Now, if you're doing this for your parents and they happen to be 85 years old, that estate tax deduction is going to be a very large percentage of what you put in. If you're doing it for your unmarried partner who's age 75, the estate tax deduction may be about half of what you put in. And if it's your 40-year-old son, it's going to be a little bit smaller. This can be a wonderful planning technique. As evidenced most clearly to me by a situation that I'm working with now, where I had actually done the planning a number of years ago, but I had two people who unmarried, both artists, and had, you know, fairly sizable estates, both liquid assets and artwork that they had both created and acquired. And they were worried about what the estate tax consequences are going to be when one of them passed away. So what we did was say, let's take the liquid assets of the first to die and put it into a charitable remainder trust for the second, because the second doesn't really need the access to the principal, but the income stream would be great. And because they're both relatively getting on in years, there's a fairly large estate tax deduction there, so very little of that charitable remainder trust, of that liquid assets they had, is going to be subject to estate tax. The second thing we did is we went to their house, and we did essentially the same thing with their house. There's a technique in the planned giving world called a life estate remainder gift, where you basically say, I give my house to charity and I reserve either to myself or, in this case, to my partner, the right to live there for life. So we did that in the estate plan. The partner had the right to live in the house for life, but because there was a big charitable component built into that remainder interest, we got a big estate tax deduction for the value of the house as well. And then finally, we took the art and actually put that into a private foundation, which is going to start loaning it out to museums and things like that. But we made use of a charitable remainder trust and a life estate remainder to give that partner what he really needed, which was access to the asset but not actual ownership of the entire asset, and got a big estate tax deduction out of it as well. So these are pretty interesting techniques. In sum, I view charitable gift planning as problem solving, and it makes the most sense when we've got a person who's got a situation. Oftentimes, a charitable gift can be a solution. Now, whether it's right for you, that all sort of depends. I'm of the firm belief that in order for this to work for you, you have to have charitable intent. There was a day when people would say you could make money by doing charitable gift planning. I don't think that was true then, and it's certainly not true now. But if you have charitable intent, there are a lot of very intelligent, very smart ways to do it. Some of these gifts are fairly straightforward, charitable gift annuities. Some of them are much more complex, charitable remainder trusts. Gifts of bequests and bequests of your IRA, again, are fairly straightforward transactions. So what I think folks ought to do, how do you do this? How do you get started? Well, one place to start is to talk to your estate planning professional. Another is if you happen to have a favorite charity, particularly the larger ones, universities and hospitals and community foundations, they have staff people that understand these techniques fairly well and would be glad to chat with you about them. But I really think sort of getting down and starting down that road is probably the best way to pass on charitable giving values to your kids, which is to do it and do it right and let them watch you do it. So thank you very much.
Our thanks to Eric Dreiberg, estate planning expert, principal in the law firm of Adler and Colvin, and board member of the Partnership for Philanthropic Planning, for his comments this evening. It's now time for today's audience question period, and we have a number of questions, so let's begin. We have several questions about after a potential donor puts a gift in a gift to a charity in their will or trust, can they then change their mind?
The answer is almost always yes. A will or trust is a revocable document, and you can amend it as you see fit. The one exclusion to that would be is if you have entered into a pledge where you have actually entered into a binding promise with charity, I will give you money, and in return they generally give you something back, like your name on the building, then you may have actually created a contractual obligation to make that gift. That is quite rare. So generally, bequests and wills or trusts are entirely revocable.
Is it possible to give my home to a charity and continue to live in it during my lifetime?
Absolutely, yes. And I just touched on that briefly. That's the life estate remainder concept. And that is, again, a very attractive situation. What you do is you literally have a deed. You record a deed that says, I give my house to charity. I reserve unto myself and perhaps my spouse the right to live here for life. So you have all the rights of a life tenant, which are the ability to live there for life. In fact, you can rent it out if you wish. You have all the responsibilities of a life tenant. You need to do the upkeep, keep it insured, make any repairs that need to happen. The beauty is, again, there is a future gift to charity in that transaction for which you are entitled to an income tax deduction today, again, based on, under the IRS tables, the presumed present value of that future gift to charity, which, again, gets to the value of the house and how old you are and so on. But it is a way to generate, I always say it's a way to generate a current income tax deduction without really changing your life very much because it's still your house.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is estate planning expert Eric Dreiberg, who is discussing how best to preserve your financial legacy for the next generation, especially in challenging economic times. Eric, is there an income tax on a Roth IRA?
Those are a little different. I've been referring to sort of the traditional IRA, not the Roths.
Yeah, okay. Is it possible for an adult to roll over and inherit an inherited IRA to their own IRA?
I'll give you two answers to that to prove I'm a lawyer, maybe three. One, it depends. Two, I don't really know because I'm actually much more of a charitable giving expert, and frankly, it's amazing that estate planning has gotten so complicated that it's broken into subgroups, and there's an entire body of folks who spend all of their time in estate planning worrying about IRAs and retirement plans, and then there are those of us that do charitable giving and so on. So I think the best answer to that question is talk to somebody that's actually an IRA expert.
Okay. Your example of the $1.5 million house, does the charity pay income stream on the entire $1.5 million? Would that be 6 to 7% or so on the $1.5 for the for a 77-year-old?
The income stream will be, in my example, 6% of fair market value of whatever portion of the house is put into the trust. In my example, I said, let's take one-third of the house and transfer it to the trust. That's $500,000 of value. So you'd be getting 6% of the $500,000. And the other two-thirds you would sell and actually have cash in hand to do with as you wished. Alternatively, I guess you could put the entire house into the charitable remainder trust. It would sell all of it tax-free, and then you'd be getting 6% of the $1.5 million sales proceeds. And frankly, I've seen transactions, perhaps with a slightly more valuable house, where folks have put in as little as 10 or 15% of the house into the charitable remainder trust just to get some tax-free sale and some income tax deduction. It's a little bit of a balancing act as to how much of the house you want to put in, but The trust is going to pay you, in my example, the 6% of whatever portion is in the trust.
Thank you. What happens when a person outlives the value of the trust given to charity? Do you still continue to get annuities?
What happens if somebody outlives, if you will? It depends on what kind of gift vehicle we're talking about. With a charitable gift annuity, and that's where you transfer money to charity and they essentially promise to pay you the annuity, in my example, $3,300 a year, the charity will pay you for your life, whether you pass life expectancy or not. And in fact, the joke in the planned giving world is that charitable gift annuities are the fountain of youth because they're gift annuity donors never seem to pass away, and the charities just keep paying and paying and paying. A charitable remainder trust is a separate legal entity. It's not you. It's also not the charity. It's a separate legal entity. It has, in my example, the $500,000 of proceeds. It's paying you 6%. Well, one big question that we didn't get into is, what is that trust going to earn in terms of investment assets? Because you need to have competent investment management. And if that trust earns, let's say, 8% over time, well, that's great. It pays you 6, it earns 8, that trust is always going to be there. If it earns 3% a year, because it is not managed very well, and it pays you out 6, at some point it's going to start getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller. And that's not the situation we want. So that is a separate legal entity, and if you, in fact, manage to mismanage the assets to the point where the trust runs into the ground, the payments will stop. So with charitable remainder trust planning, there needs to be very careful thought given as to what the payout rate is and then how the trust is going to be invested and who's going to be in charge of investing the trust so that there is you're comfortable that it's going to be managed prudently, because that one does, in a sense, have some risk at the back end.
How can I be certain that my wishes will be honored by a charity I leave money to in my will?
Well, one thing we see a lot of these days are fairly detailed gift restrictions. We see people giving money to charity, and it's not just here's $100,000. It's here's $100,000, and this is what I'd like you to do with it for the scholarship program, for the violin department. And sometimes the gift restriction happens to go on for a page and a half. A couple of ways to make sure it's going to happen. One is talk to the charity when you're drafting your will. And if you're not comfortable with them knowing who you are, have your advisor talk to the charity and explain to them what you want to do. Because they may come back and say, you know, that just doesn't work for us. We just can't run your gift that way. We can't use it in that fashion. And then you know you've got an issue. But if you work with the charity and develop a gift restriction that they're comfortable with, and they say, yes, if you leave us the money, we can do that, then I think, in fact, you have a very high likelihood that they are, in fact, going to follow your wishes. Now, if you're working with a large enough gift, and that's a relative term, but I'm probably talking well into the millions here, you can start to draft an elaborate gift agreement with the charity that really lays out exactly what they're going to do with the money, and you can actually start to build in some enforcement provisions. You know, every year the charity shall report to my daughter as to how they used my gift. And if it turns out the charity isn't using it exactly the way I told them to, she has standing to go into court and argue about it. You're not going to do that with a smaller bequest, but I've certainly worked with a lot of very large bequests where, in fact, you find some enforcement provisions built in. But I find the best solution is to talk to the charity and make sure that what you're doing is going to work for them. And then, of course, I find they're more than glad to actually carry that out after the fact.
How will a charitable remainder trust that is established in one state, how will it be affected if you later take residence in another state?
Well, that's a great question. It should have, in terms of the core administration provisions and the core elements, meaning I get income every year at 6% or 5%, those should remain unchanged. The questions I think you will find are, depending upon who you've selected as trustee, and you can self-trustee your own charitable remainder trust, although that is often not a great idea. You can select a banker fiduciary, bank trust company fiduciary to manage your trustee or manage your charitable remainder trust, often a great idea. That shouldn't change too much. What you do need to worry about are the income tax consequences on the payout, because some charitable remainder trusts, you know, if you're in the state of California, those payments to you are going to be taxable in California. When you start moving out of state, you need to sort of sort out with the advisor in that state whether it's going to be taxable to you in that state. I think in some states it's actually taxable wherever you set up the trust, regardless of where you live afterwards. But that's a state law issue. But sort of as to the core, will I still get my payments? The answer is yes.
At what age should people start planning their legacy giving, and how often should this be revisited?
Well, the second question is probably easier than the first. I think the second question really gets to, I tell people that they really ought to revisit their plans every 5 years. And I do that because I think they will then at least do it every 10 years, which I think is sort of the minimum. So that's sort of how I come at that. Now, or unless there's a major life event, either on the family side or on the financial side, if your situation has changed a lot, obviously you need to open the door and rethink about it. The question of when you should start, I really think, depends a lot on you. You know, some people wait until they get fairly near the end of their life, when they feel much more secure about their assets and their life and where they're going to be for the balance of their life, then they feel like they're more comfortable making charitable gifts. Other people find themselves facing a large liquidity event. They're selling the commercial apartment buildings that they used to enjoy managing but no longer care to. They started the dot-com company, and they're selling it for $100 million. That isn't so true these days, but was a while ago. Those folks see a big liquidity event, a big change, and they plan their gifts at that point. And then we also see a lot of people who really are sort of coming at it also, again, from the values-based planning. They want their kids to start seeing that giving back to society is important. So once their kids are sort of the age where they can start to realize what's going on and appreciate it, they start doing charitable giving, albeit in a smaller way, so they can really show the kids what's going on and get the kids participating. And we see folks, you know, doing that in their 40s and 50s. But we generally find that it is either the big liquidity event or folks that have sort of gotten into their 70s and are starting to feel comfortable with where they are and where they want to send their estate.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is estate planning expert Eric Dreiberg, who is discussing how best to preserve your financial legacy for the next generation, especially in challenging times. Eric, family foundations are often used for both family and philanthropic reasons. Can you give us some pros and cons of family foundations?
Sure. Family foundations are wonderful vehicles. And to a tax lawyer, that's a private foundation. And that's when somebody sets up their own charity. So they literally go out and create a 501c3. We've all heard that term. Charity. They form the entity, they apply to the Internal Revenue Service and get tax-exempt status. Here we have to get tax-exempt status from their franchise tax board. And it is actually a charity. And contributions they make to their foundation are fully deductible for income tax purposes. And then the foundation operates to make grants out to the charitable causes folks believe in. It's a wonderful way to create a charitable giving vehicle. And again, we see people do this either when they have are of more substantial means or have a large liquidity event. Perhaps they transfer some of their to-be-sold assets into the private foundation and let the foundation sell them because they are, of course, tax-exempt. It is often used, frankly, when folks are retiring from their active business, selling their valuable assets, and are starting to sort of wonder what they're going to do in retirement. And a private foundation, a family foundation, is often, I view, sort of like a small business. It just happens to be a philanthropic small business, and your business is making grants out to other public charities. But, in fact, there is a legal entity there, and you get to talk to your investment advisors and file tax returns. You get to talk to charities and sort out what grantees you want to support and what good programs they're doing. And oftentimes people actually make it into a nice little second career. The foundations are not without their costs. They are somewhat expensive and complicated to set up. They are separate legal entities that file their own tax returns every year. So there's a fair bit of administration work involved. And there are certainly folks out there that will help you with that administration work if you wish. I just want to note that there is an alternative to the Family Foundation, and certainly I'm a great fan of Family Foundations and set up a lot of them, but there is also the concept of a donor-advised fund. And there are entities, there are charitable entities, often sort of one per community. They're called community foundations. And there's the San Francisco Community Foundation, and there's the Marin Community Foundation, the Silicon Valley, and so on and so forth across the country. And these are large charities whose real mission is collecting money from individuals and other sources, holding them in funds, and making grants out to the operating charities in their community. So they support the good charitable causes in their community. And you can create your own advised fund inside the community foundation, and it'll have your name on it, and you can advise. You can't control. You don't control it as you would a family foundation, but you can advise the community foundation as to where to grant the money that you have contributed to your fund. And that's a wonderful way to accomplish much of what you get with a private foundation without some of the cost. Now, of course, you don't control it. They do. And you don't quite have the sense of this is mine, and it's a legacy I can pass down the generations, and it's always going to have my family name on it, a la the Ford Foundation and the Kellogg Foundation. But it tends to work with smaller gift amounts, whereas a private foundation is often viewed as needing a little bit more money just to support itself.
I have a number of questions about locating worthy charities, and I think I'll combine a couple of these. How do I find a worthy charity for a planned gift? And also, is it better for individuals to give to multiple charities or just a few?
Well, that's a fairly hard question, especially the latter. I think the issue of should I give to one charity or give to a few, I think you need to follow your heart. You should give to the charities you care about. And if there's one, you should give to that. And if there are multiple, you should give to multiple. Certainly there is, an argument that a small amount of money scattered around a number of charities may not really be meaningful in the hands of any one of them. On the other hand, every charity I know is more than glad to get $250. It's $250 more than they had before. But I do think you can have a bigger impact if you leave a larger sum of money to one organization. You can really start to accomplish something that way. How do you find charities? Well, there are plenty of them out there, and they're pretty present. There are a couple of research tools you can do. I frankly think the place you ought to start is going and talking to them and walking around and getting to know the people and getting to know the programs and see if you like it. There are some internet tools you can use. In particular, I happen to use GuideStar.org a lot, and it has a lot of information, rather financial numerical kind of information about the charity. In fact, if you sign up, I think you can even get copies of the tax returns for the charities, and you can just go search them out. So there's a wealth of information there, as long as a description of their mission and board members and things like that. And in fact, for people that are really sort of struggling with this issue and are contemplating some larger gifts and thus have a little bit of money to spend on this research function, there are some folks in town who are philanthropic advisors, and that's how they bill themselves. And their job is to really sit down and work with you to help you sort out what your philanthropic mission is, which kinds of charities fit into those missions, and then maybe sort of help you get a sense of what they're doing, what programs are out there that might be of interest, and they can really be sort of your personal philanthropic coach. You can also get some of that advice from the community foundations I mentioned earlier. So they have program officers whose job it is all day long is to focus in on their area, social justice, the environment, animal rights, whatever it is, and they get to know all of the charities out there doing that kind of work. They know the people on the ground, which ones are more effective, which ones are less effective, and if you spend some time with your community foundation, they can really help you get your hands around that. The one sidebar I want to note here is one issue that comes up a lot in this whole discussion is I want to find a charity that doesn't spend anything on administration. I want all of my money to go to program. Or if I make a gift, I don't want any of the money spent on administration. I want it all for program. And while that may make you feel good, I would try to point out that if what you want is a charity that is going to do the right thing with your money and is effective, right, they need to have some internal infrastructure. They need to have some administration. You want to find a charity that is well run. And if it's going to be well run, that means there are going to be some people who are going to be working there who probably want to get paid, and you are going to find your charity has administration costs. Charities that have no admin costs whatsoever or squeeze them down to the bare minimum, well, there can't be a whole lot of work going on over there. And I sometimes worry that they may have great-looking statistics because all of their money is used on program, but I'm not so sure whether it's effective as if they had some good people who were dedicated to the cause and were earning a living wage and could really help move that charity forward. So I'm a great believer in a little bit of admin cost.
What do you think about other restricted gifts for charities? You've commented on administrative cost restrictions,
right.
But what about other things?
Well, you know, certainly, again, we see a lot of folks who are wishing to really focus the use of their charitable gift. And, you know, that's been with us for a long time. Folks were doing that back in the, you know, I've been working on client matters where the governing will or trust that laid forth all of the restrictions as to how the donor's money was going to be used, you know, was done in 1896. Another one I worked on was done in 1937. So people have been trying to sort of focus their charitable gifts for quite a while. And I think it's a wonderful idea. I mean, if you have some idea of what you think the charity should be accomplishing and you have talked to them and they say this works for us, I think that's wonderful. Why not give them some focus? It's when the lawyer spends, you know, a fair bit of time drafting, in one case, I think, a 14-page gift restriction, and this was 14-inch paper, by the way, because it was back from 1937, and drops it in the charity's hands after the donor's gone, so there's no chance to negotiate it, sometimes you can find that some of those restrictions are a little problematic. So, again, talk to the charity up front. Second thing is you should expect them, if you are giving a fair gift that is going to be in their hands for a long time and has some fairly restrictive provisions, you should expect them to come back to you and say, you know, this is great. This all works for us now. But, you know, this is a long-term charitable gift. Perhaps you're doing an endowed gift, which is supposed to, you know, spend out income every year in perpetuity. And as a friend of mine once pointed out, perpetuity is a very long time. So what's going to happen 50 years from now, 75 years from now, 100 years from now? Things are going to look very different. You know, the needs of the charity in that 1937 document I reviewed are not the needs of that charity in 2008, much less 2009. So what you should expect the charity to do is to come back and say, this is all great, but what we would like is the power to vary your gift slightly. If we decide that your gift is no longer workable, it becomes illegal for some reason, it's impracticable, we'd like the ability to change your gift into something that is still usable for us, consistent with the general mission you've laid out. So you should expect to get that pushback if you're going to make a very restricted long-term gift.
I'm going to ask you a little bit of a quasi-political question. On a national level, do you believe foundations should be required to spend more than the 5% required by law? Some believe that increasing this to 10% would benefit society and still have a minimal effect on the life of the foundation.
Should we increase the minimum payout rate on private foundations? I think the investment people in the audience would tell you that an entity that has a 5% distribution requirement, a little bit of administration costs, and inflation to worry about is going to have a very hard time making it into perpetuity even with just the 5% payout rate. And the studies I've seen is that you really want, if you want some confidence your entity is going to be there forever, your payout rate ought to be closer to 4%, which, of course, you can't do with a private foundation because we have a minimum distribution of 5%. Raising it would only exacerbate the problem. So I actually think as a matter of law it ought to stay at 5%. I think that is a moderately aggressive payout rate as it is. I think there is a good question raised, though, as to whether, in fact, that is right for everybody that sets up a foundation. And we are starting to see more people who are really adopting the theory of the question asked, which is to say they're designing their foundations to spend out over a certain period of time. Because they, as the person who asked the question, do believe that what I want to get the most bang out of my buck, I want to see it get out into the charitable hands sooner rather than later, and I'm not interested in just creating a big bank account that's going to spin out a little bit of income. So they are drafting into their documents that this foundation will last 20 years after my death, or I'm setting this up for a 50-year term, and my trustees or directors must spend it out over that time. But I prefer to leave that to the decision-making of the person setting it up rather than by mandating it by law.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there is time for only for one last question. Do some major charitable organizations with a legal department prepare the paperwork free of charge?
Absolutely. A lot of the larger organizations will either have lawyers on staff, hospitals, universities, community foundations, or they will have retained the services of an attorney so that if you sit down with them and say, look, I am wanting to do a charitable gift here, particularly gift annuities, charitable remainder trusts, life estate remainders, they will prepare the documents for you and your counsel to review. Now, it's very, you know, they try to be very clear that, look, we're working on behalf of the charity, and you should take this to your own your own advisors to get it reviewed, but they can take care of that. What I am less comfortable with is people that come to charity and say, well, I'd like to do this transaction. I'd like to use my lawyer, but I'd like you, the charity, to pay my lawyer. I don't think that's really quite fair and is a bit of a conflict of interest, but a lot of the larger charities will be able to do that, those documents for you.
Our thanks to Eric Dreiberg, estate planning expert, principal in the law firm of Adler and Colvin, and board member of the Partnership for Philanthropic Planning, for his comments this evening. We also thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Jack Cordes, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.